Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of The Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, a nonprofit living laboratory for accomplishing social change. It is my privilege to host this podcast where we talk with change leaders about our human potential for creating a more healthy and humane world. I'm so pleased to welcome Jacob Harold as my guest on Making Change. As Jacob tells it, his career in the world of social change and community benefit was simply a matter of stepping into the family business. Both his parents were social workers, and every step of his education and profession has been a step along the path to creating change. Bringing together years of experience as a consultant, an activist, a researcher, and most recently as a foundation program officer, Jacob is now the CEO of GuideStar, where his personal mission is to move GuideStar to the next level of data collection, to find ways to gather and share data about impact, the things that really matter. Given the extent to which his life has been all about making a difference, it is my pleasure to have Jacob Harold share his observations with us today, here on Making Change. My guest today on Making Change is Jacob Harold. Welcome, Jacob.
I'm very glad to be here, Hilde.
Can you tell us a little bit about the path of your life that has led you to this new position that you're in at GuideStar?
Of course. I'd be happy to. I grew up in North Carolina, the son of two social workers who worked at nonprofits. So this very much is the family business for me. My dad ran Catholic Social Services in Central North Carolina, and my mother worked at an AIDS hospice, and they worked on immigration issues and prisoner recidivism, and it very much was the context of my youth in a lot of ways. And in a piece of that was the reality that it's hard to run a nonprofit and it's hard to raise money. It's hard to feel connected to the broader world. And the one rebellion that I could come up with against my parents was to really try and work on national and international issues. It's about all I could find to rebel against was their eternally local focus. And so in college, before I really dove into my social change career, I really thought that I would be an academic, and I studied philosophy and religion and math, sort of the history of ideas, and began campus activism on a number of issues. And I discovered this organization called Green Corps that is what they call themselves a field school for environmental organizing, a one-year fellowship to learn how to be a grassroots organizer of environmental issues, and stumbled across it in the Career Center in college and ended up applying. And that experience really led me to sort of the next phase, which was working on climate change, not as an organizer, but as a campaigner, with the distinction being, not so much embedded in a community trying to build support for a particular issue, but working on a national level. And I did that for Greenpeace and Rainforest Action Network and others. And was struck by a few things. One, that it was possible to make progress, but that ultimately we were failing. And also that climate change was a problem of commerce gone wrong. That a lot of the work that I was doing, for example, Rainforest Action Network, I helped to launch a campaign to put pressure on Ford Motor Company to accelerate its transition to cleaner vehicles. And I realized to a certain extent, who am I to try and change a business when I don't know very much about business? And so that led me to business school, and I was lucky enough to be able to go to Stanford, which in some ways is one of the capitals of capitalism, although in a different way than some other business schools, and given its placement in Silicon Valley and its historic focus, applying those principles to social change. And that experience was quite extraordinary, mostly because I didn't know anything when I showed up. So I mentioned I got to use the language of economics that I learned there. I got more marginal learning out of it than my classmates did, because I was so ignorant upon arrival, and really wanted to continue work on climate change, but with this additional skill set, and got a chance to work for the Packard Foundation in India, exploring how the foundation could make investments around climate change mitigation there, and then helped to launch the first initiative on climate change at a major business school my second year. That was at Stanford.
Okay.
There was sort of a school-wide year-long initiative on climate change. And through that, got to know people at the Hewlett Foundation, where I eventually worked. And that was also one of the things that I think allowed me to get a job at the Brinspan Group, the strategy consulting firm for nonprofits and foundations, after I graduated. I will say one thing that I did. This was only 6 weeks, but I think it's actually important. I spent 6 weeks in Beijing studying complex system science at the Chinese Academy of Sciences through a program that was jointly run by the Santa Fe Institute, or which is the great think tank on issues of complex systems, whether those are economic systems or physical systems or social systems, cultural ones. That gave me new frameworks and ways of understanding how our complex world really works. And then a great opportunity at the Bridgespan Group, really my first time within a formal professional organization. And so that was just very good for solidifying what I learned in business school. Mm-hmm. And that led me to the Hilo Foundation and spent 6.5 years really trying to help build a philanthropic system that was capable of solving the great challenges of our time. And you know, my lens is always through climate change. And it was clear to me that we were not going to solve a complex problem like climate change unless we were much smarter about allocating resources across different strategies, across different geographies, across different organizations than we had been so far, not to mention just much smarter about coordination across organizations and learning across organizations.
Right.
So, you know, while at Hewlett I did a good bit of work on climate, but it was broader than that. You know, how do you build an infrastructure, I like to call it a scaffolding, for social change? And really became particularly focused on the question of information scaffolding. How does information get collected, aggregated, distributed, displayed in a way that helps people trying to make the world better, whether those are donors or nonprofit executives, journalists or academics, volunteers, give them access to the information they need to make a good decision. And you know, that eventually led me to deep engagement with GuideStar, this spot on the GuideStar board, and then eventually this role that I'm in right now as president and CEO. And I really will say that all these different steps along the way, every single one of them is relevant to the job right now, whether that's my parents' experience within small community-based nonprofits or work as a grassroots organizer learning the basics of social change strategy, to the frameworks I learned in business school, to complex system science, and here I am.
It's always fascinating to me that I love to ask this question and love to hear the path that has led people to where they are. And so frequently we don't realize that there's a path and that it is actually guiding us someplace until we look back and go, holy, look at that. There was actually a path and every step of it made a difference for where I am right now.
I think that's exactly right. I do feel very blessed to be, I feel very prepared for this job. That doesn't mean that I'll do a good job, but I can't imagine a better and more useful set of experiences and formal training as well to make me ready to do my best to tackle this work.
That's great. So the question that I begin all of my interviews with in this long, winding career of yours so far, when you see change happening on the ground in communities and real change happening, what do you see undergirding that change? What do you see happening and causing change?
Well, this may seem abstract, but one thing that I will reflect on at least is that the times where it really works, there are always multiple frameworks that people are using to achieve their work. So let me explain what I mean by that. Mm-hmm. So the Rainforest Action Network is a relatively small environmental group, about $3 million a year annual budget, that is very aggressive. They will chain themselves to the doors of a bank. They will rappel off of a building with a giant banner. But then they will put on a suit and they will go talk to the corporate executives they're trying to influence. They very intentionally bring together the kind of intellectual framework of radical environmental campaigning with an understanding of markets, with an understanding of the actual incentives that are operating on corporate decision makers. And that's why in my mind, Rainforest Action Network has been very successful in getting major concessions out of a number of major corporations in forestry, in finance, in the automobile industry. And there are other examples as well, whether it's merging complex systems science with storytelling, which in some ways I think is what I'm trying to do at GuideStar. And I'd say that's what Facebook, for example, has done, is Facebook has brought the lessons from network theory, from complexity science, and figured out how to merge that with storytelling at an individual level and then at an organizational level. Or whether it's policy reform engaged with behavioral economics and these two different framework brought together to help shift how we structure incentives for people about decisions in their life. So I think that in the 21st century, we have to have multiple lenses for viewing the world, and we have to figure out how to combine them sometimes in order to get the world unstuck.
I'm fascinated by both of the two that you mentioned, in addition to what Rainforest Action Alliance did. Talk a little bit about that merger you're seeing of complex system science and storytelling.
Well, it's very much true for Guidestar. I mean, we're in many ways just getting started. But, you know, complex system science, a classic example in my mind is the brain. That, you know, the brain is made up of many simple interactions which are networked together, neurons talking to each other, which by themselves are relatively explainable. But when you look at what's called the emergent property, in this case consciousness, that rises out of all of these little simple interactions, you see that that which emerges cannot be explained by all the little connections.
Right.
Just the way watching a flock of birds that somehow manages to fly as one, and that is an aggregate of individual birds communicating with each other. And so one of the powers of technology is it allows us to weave connections together on a grand scale. Mm-hmm. And in the nonprofit world, a lot of what we're doing is we're adding up stories. We're adding up the individual interactions that, you know, a nonprofit employee has with a beneficiary, for example, or two mm-hmm. nonprofit executives have together. And so, you know, Guidestar, I believe, is positioned to help weave all these individual stories into something that adds up. And my hope, my bet, the thing that I in some ways bet my career on, is that there will be extraordinary emergent properties if we get that right.
Talk a little bit about what you're doing with Guidestar that's facilitating that.
Sure. Guidestar has historically focused on financial data simply because the bulk of our content comes from the IRS Form 990 that nonprofits
right.
are required to file.
Right.
That makes up the bulk of the 1.5 billion pieces of data that we currently have, and it has been an incredibly important foundation for our work. But if we really want to get to the substance of social change, the work that nonprofits do that matters, that justifies their existence, we have to move beyond that to other kinds of information, whether that's feedback from beneficiaries or surveys of experts or programmatic data provided directly by the nonprofits. And so, just as I would say the availability of financial data has in some ways transformed accountability in the nonprofit sector, mm-hmm. I think the true availability of programmatic information, multiple kinds of it, I think can transform how we think about social change and how we think about learning and how we think about collaboration. And, you know, you reduce the cost to learn. You reduce the cost to collaborate.
Right.
And extraordinary things can happen. So that's one piece. The other piece of it is really recognizing that we can't do this alone. So right. I remember having, I often tell the story of having brunch with a friend of mine who worked at Google. And I said, just joined the board of Guidestar. And I proudly explained that we had 10 million users every year. and my friend at Google said, well, we have 10 million users every minute. And that moment was just a reminder that if we isolate ourselves in the nonprofit sector, that has all sorts of cultural implications that are problematic. But with the emergence of the internet as a dominant strata of the human experience, our isolation can really get exaggerated unless we figure out how to play with all the other partners. Yeah, there are 600 million websites in the world, and you know, if we say, "Oh, we're going to create a website and that's going to create change," chances are we're wrong. But we can weave together with these other sites. We already are providing data that's used on 60 other platforms.
Now, is that financial data that you're providing, or
it's primarily financial data, some governance and operational data, but as we begin to gather more programmatic data, it will also be programmatic data.
The thing that we always hear is that we measure what's easy to measure, and that the reason that we measure financial data is because it's so easy to measure, and it's so easy to collect, and it's so easy to report out. And I'm curious about some of the nuts and bolts of how you're aggregating. What are the actual data points that you would be aggregating?
So I would, let me just start by saying I completely agree. And I think generally it makes sense to start with what's easy, but you just can't forget to then move on to what's harder.
Yeah. Sometimes what we find is that when we start with what's easy, we get stuck with what's easy and we stay there for 20 years.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. So when it comes to programmatic data, so there are a number of answers to this. And I actually think it's important that there be multiple answers because
right. The
nonprofit sector is too diverse for any one framework to apply across the board. But I'll just mention a few of the ways.
Yeah.
So, you know, one is just a simple partnership that we have with great nonprofits that allows any stakeholder of any nonprofit to just share a review of that, whether that's a donor or volunteer or staff member or beneficiary of that organization. That's programmatic data. By itself, it's not that meaningful, but when brought in the context of other kinds of information, I think it can be quite powerful. So another would be structured formal surveys of experts. So, for example, thinking about advocacy organizations, with advocacy organizations that maybe are, say, trying to change policy, the end beneficiary is several steps down the road, and they often don't have a good line of sight to which advocacy organization is effective.
Right.
But you can be systematic about surveying those who do have a good line of sight, whether those are peer organizations or journalists or even the policymakers that you're trying to influence. They have a sense of who is truly effective. You have to do that intentionally, and it's not perfect, but it's another data point. That's what Philanthropedia, just a division of GuideStar, does. Another approach is what I would call structured qualitative information. And that is simply asking very clear questions, which nonprofits can answer in systematic ways, one hopes, and then you're able to compare across organizations. So that's a project that we've done with the Better Business Bureau and Independent Sector.
Mm-hmm.
Called Charting Impact, which asks five basic questions for nonprofits, which I think are actually more or less universal. What are you trying to accomplish? How will you get there? What are you going to measure? What's your capacity? And what's happened so far? And in these cases, the fundamental criterion in my mind is clarity.
Mm-hmm.
Is a nonprofit clear when it's answering those questions, which is actually often incredibly difficult. It can be very hard to be clear. So that's another category. Then another category I would say, and this is where we want to get over time, is quantitative programmatic data. Now, the challenge is that a homeless shelter does not measure the same thing that a climate change advocacy group measures, and nor should it. So you need to have different measures across different issue areas and across different strategies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it doesn't make sense for GuideStar or most anyone else to impose from the top down exactly what the measure should be. So that's actually a much heavier lift technically and operationally, and that's going to take us a couple of years. But over time, we will begin to really have some structured programmatic data, which is not always going to be comparable, and that's fine. But at least we'll be able to show trends over time and be a place to start conversations and hopefully accelerate learning. Then there are other categories as well. Social science research about what works. There are not efficient mechanisms of learning between academia and the nonprofit sector.
Oh, that's been forever.
Yeah. But that's a solvable problem, I think.
Yep.
And then, then there are other categories. There are just, free-form documents, there's photos, there's video. There are so many different ways that we can think about exploring the performance of nonprofits. And our challenge is to have multiple approaches brought together in a way that is useful but not overbearing.
It's interesting, as I'm listening to you talk, that there's the whole sense of that we're stronger together than we are individually, obviously, that whole weaving of connections together. The ability for organizations to learn from each other that it seems like your systems are aiming at. But one of the things that I'm sensing is that so many organizations are built around what they do. And there's a lot of work to be done. We don't always have the luxury of sitting back and looking at what is the framework? What is the lens through which we are seeing? Are we using multiple frameworks? Are we pulling things together at a theoretical level? And I'm almost seeing that the exposure to various lenses through which they can view their work and tell their story, that's powerful in and of itself, that it encourages a different kind of thinking.
I think that's exactly right. And the question is, how do we get to the point where people are engaged enough that it does encourage a different kind of thinking? And it's sort of classic triangulation. If you can get people to see and be exposed to in systematic ways these other points that can help them understand where they are in a landscape, or where they are in a process of learning, or where they are in kind of a broader social change context. But people don't, in the nonprofit sector, don't have lots of time to just kind of sit back and do that.
Right.
There are many efforts to help create that space, and those are incredibly valuable, whether that's through retreats or sabbaticals or working groups or consulting firms, training programs. You know, there are many, many ways to create that.
Right.
But I also think our fundamental leverage point as a technology-driven organization is convenience. The way that we can get people's attention is by making things easier for them. And it's through that element of convenience that I think we are going to actually be able to get this information in front of people. And what that requires is, again, not just assuming that people are going to type in GuideStar.org, even if 10 million people do a year.
Right.
And instead have this information presented to them where they're already operating. Whether that's a foundation in their, grants management software, or they're a nonprofit in their donor management software, or through Google, Facebook, eBay, and others. So those are platforms that people use on a daily basis, and the right information can show up in those places. And we're in conversation with a number of those platforms in various ways. And I think when it comes to donors in particular, it's actually their financial institutions. How do we embed meaningful information in financial institutions? And then more broadly than just the data showing up on a website, even if it's a website that's much bigger and more important than ours, it's information showing up in people's processes.
Right.
Showing up not just in the right place, but at the right time. I think that with a user-centered approach that's thoughtful about convenience, I think that we can get this data in front of people in a way that will matter, in a way that
they can use it.
Yeah, and then ultimately, I will hope, gets to your question, transforming how people think and giving them that multidimensional, rich sense of their own context and their own work and what they can do next.
You hear so often people talk about a think and do tank, that there's the thinking part and then there's the doing part. And for the work that we're doing at Creating the Future, there's a huge R&D component, which this podcast is a part of. But the bigger question for us is, okay, once you learn that stuff, how do you move that knowledge out into the world so that change makers, oh my gosh, this is what creates change, that they have it. This is what others are doing. These are the stories, the way that they're telling them. These are the lenses through which it is helpful to see things. How do we move that knowledge out into the world so that folks not only have the data, but have the theory behind the data of why is that important? Why, what is it about this that I can actually use?
Exactly. And this gets to a concept that I think is very important for social change, which is the idea of division of labor across organizations. And the idea that, a content creator, it shouldn't necessarily be their responsibility to get the content out. It's hard for an organization to simultaneously develop both of those skill sets at a really meaningful level. And so what becomes really important is the interface between organizations.
Ooh.
And us having the humility to really focus on what we're good at, and then also the faith in our partners that they'll handle another piece of it. And,
that's a very different strategic lens through which to see things. To really see one's role, we're so used to hearing the stick with the knitting, stick with what you're good at, but also then look at what are the pieces, where are the pieces that would fit into that, and who's doing those pieces? Mm-hmm. How do you integrate that into the bigger whole by integrating with others? It's a great approach.
It relies on having a handful of players that have really mastered their own piece. And actually, I would argue, to harken back to my last job, this is a place where foundations are really important, to really look at landscapes and to understand where the gaps are and to really double down on a place where there is a gap. And it can be hard to do that because, there are lots of reasons why it can be hard to do that, one of which is just that it's very easy to be perceived as arrogant. But I believe it can be done humbly, and I think it's actually really essential because we don't have time to sort of waste with lots of duplication and inefficiency at the systems level.
Right.
The problems we're facing are too big to have so much unnecessary duplication and yet to leave so many holes unfilled.
One of the things that I've long held about foundations is that regardless of how tremendous their financial endowment might be, they have far more information about their communities than they'll ever have money. Because everybody comes to them and unloads, whether the grant was approved or not, they've got tons of data there. They know everything about the need, the numbers, mm-hmm. and there really is an untapped resource there in foundations who have just tons and tons of information. Aggregate that, and we'd know a lot more about our communities.
Yeah. And, you know, be willing to act upon it, too.
Absolutely.
But I understand why foundations hesitate, because there's this sort of assumption that the perception will be, well, the foundation is doing this because they think they're smarter than everyone. But often it's just because solely by virtue of having money, they just have better information, and better bird's eye view, simply by picking up the phone.
I want to harken back to one of the other frameworks that you mentioned, the combination of policy reform engaged with behavioral economics. Can you give an example of that?
Sure. The classic example is employees signing up for a 401k match, that if you change the default from no to yes, you shift by 40%, I can't remember the right number, by a huge amount, you shift the number of people who sign up for a retirement program, and that's actually really important for their future. And mm-hmm. You're not taking away the choice by any means. You're simply changing the context of that choice. There are certainly some concerns that that's too paternalistic, but I would argue that as long as the choice is present and clear, that it doesn't have to be too paternalistic. This plays out in some really interesting ways, and it gets back to the convenience piece for an organization like GuideStar. You know, we would like to facilitate people making smart decisions with their philanthropic mm-hmm. giving, but we also don't ever want to take away that choice, nor could we. But if we think about, we make choices about how we present information, that can matter. And if we do it right, it can matter in useful and productive ways.
And tell a little bit about how that fits in with policy reform.
Well, I'm trying to think of a good example there. The question of defaults, are choices opt-in or opt-out, is a very important lever in policy, in tax policy, you know, in retirement policy, healthcare, et cetera. And, you know, just, you know, a simple question like, is the default that people are or are not organ donors? And, you know, how do we think about that? That's a policy choice, one that can have huge impacts. And, you know, good and bad. I mean, you have to navigate through the complexity. And, you know, there are certain times where it's important to keep something, for example, as an opt-in. But we need to be thoughtful about the fact that in our complex world, and really in any world, people are not always rational. They only have so much attention that they can focus in a really thoughtful, deliberate way. And that we need to help people make better decisions while never taking away their freedom.
Well, if there were ever a statement that wraps up everything that you have shared with us today, I think that is it. I love the thought of giving people choices, but looking at those choices within a whole series of different lenses, because that really is, when people are creating change, it is looking at things through those different lenses. And so I'm looking very, very forward to watching your path and watching what GuideStar does over the coming months and years, and watching how that creates change. Thank you so much, Jacob, for being with us.
Absolutely, Hildy. It was a pleasure.
Listening to Jacob, one thing becomes quickly clear. When we change the lens through which we see things, things change. And that shouldn't be surprising. Our human brains are wired for vision. It's why so many of our expressions are rooted in words that relate to seeing. When we talk about imagining, we call it envisioning. When we describe what is possible, we call that vision. When we consider different ways of understanding an issue, we call that a point of view. And when we try to consider those different frameworks, those viewpoints, we talk about seeing the world through a different lens. There's another powerful force that leads the way we humans think, and that is our propensity for understanding the world through stories. When we combine those two powerful forces of the human brain, changing the way we see and then changing the stories we tell, that is when it feels like the very ground below us is somehow shifting. What that means for change agents is powerful. As Jacob's examples show, the more conscious we are about the stories and the frameworks through which we see the world, the more powerful we become as agents of change. I loved the story Jacob told about the Rainforest Action Alliance, who would chain themselves to a fence one day and then clean up to talk about the business strategy of financial markets the next. Whether it is moving smoothly from global activist to business activist, or a small grassroots organization that tells stories through data one day and through the eyes of a child the next, the power to see through those various lenses creates a serious 1-2 punch for creating change, which leads to questions for your own work. What story are you telling yourself about the work that you do? Is it a story that says we can't achieve more until we have this or that? Or is it a story of strength, a story that says we have everything we need and we know everyone we need to know? Do your organization's leaders tell themselves the story of connectivity, seeing everything through the lens of interdependence? Or is the story about surviving on your own? Is it a story about what is possible or a story of frustration? Second, how do you know that the story you're telling is true? Is it backed by data? Is it backed by consistent stories of results in people's lives? If you were asked for indicators that your story is true and not simply something you believe to be true, what indicators might verify your facts? Third, how might your organization's actions change if you shifted your point of view? If your program is about working with older adults, what might change if you saw your work through their eyes? If you're working with families, what might change if you saw your program through the eyes of a 5-year-old, or a 13-year-old, or a 35-year-old? What would change if your board saw your programs through the eyes of your employees? And lastly, what might become possible if you took the time to consider all those various points of view? Organizational leaders are often so busy doing the work, they rarely take the time to think, and certainly don't often take the time to think together. What might it make possible if you allowed time at every staff meeting and every board meeting and every team meeting, time to think, time to wonder, what might it make possible if we took the time to consider this issue through a different lens? As you begin exploring these big questions, I hope you'll share your observations at Creating the Future's Facebook page at facebook.com/creatingthefuture. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me through our website at creatingthefuture.org or on Twitter at Hilde Gottlieb. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for your community and our world. For Creating the Future and the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hilde Gottlieb. We'll see you next month here on Making Change.